Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, my fine friends. Welcome to the next episode of season 9.5 of the Tom Petty Project podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. This is the weekly podcast that digs into the entire Tom Petty catalogue, song by song, album by album, and includes conversations with musicians, fans, and people connected with Tom along the way. This is another special non-Petty episode of the podcast with the fantastic Jake Thistle, who found time in his insanely busy schedule to sit down with me to discuss his label debut, The Half Left Out. We chatted a little bit about Gainesville and Tom, of course, but mainly we dug into the weeds around his full debut release with topics ranging from album sequencing, how different producers bring different perspectives to songs, and how to avoid cliche. And Jake has a fairly direct way of dealing with that one. We also dug into the brilliant video for Brooklyn Can Wait and talked through each track on the album in a little more depth. Jake has a new live album coming out sometime in the next few months and already has demos recorded for most of a new studio recording, which will be coming out sometime, hopefully soon. In the meantime, make sure you check out jakethistle.com and go support Jake at a live show if he's playing anywhere near you. For now, though, sit back, relax, and enjoy my second conversation with Jake Thistle. Tom Petty. Tom Petty.
Okay, so how's life? I mean, I was looking through, it's been just about 2 years since you were last on the podcast. So it's been a while. There's a lot has happened in the last 2 years for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, it went quick, for sure. Yeah. But I'm very happy to be back. Yeah, things have been great. I've been keeping really, really busy and, you know, enjoying being busy. So they work together.
When I was, you know, obviously following on Facebook and whatnot, the touring, like the gigging, the recording, the writing, the work for, you know, different charities, as well as a full academic load. Are you still doing okay? Like everything's still, you're still managing all that okay?
Yeah, so far so good. Yeah. Today was, before this, primarily a homework day. So right. I am more than welcoming this conversation because it's nice to switch gears a little bit. But yeah, things have been good. I'm a double major communication and journalism. So it's a lot of writing and a lot of PR talk and things like that, but
yeah,
that's been great. It helps me in a variety of ways for the music stuff, which is why I picked it, because they're, I mean, in addition to being a ridiculously versatile and large major, both of them, you know, it helps me work with the publicist and it helps me write and kind of learn human interests and things like that, which I think help the songwriting a lot too. So, you know, they're a little more blended than I often give them credit for, but it's been great.
Well, and of course, you know, in the modern era where an independent artist, you sort of have to be your own PR guy, you have to be in charge of your own social media, you have to do all those things. So having that background, that education in better ways or more efficient ways of doing that, it's always going to be a boon. And I was thinking too that, you know, your friend Jeff Slate has that background too. So if you ever have any questions on the journalism side especially, you've got a resource there that you can lean on, right?
That's right. Yeah, he was a... He was a journalism major, political science minor, and that was what I initially was going in for. Right. So that was great. Since then, they don't let me minor because I have the double major.
Okay.
I think I could probably convince him if I worked hard enough, the SCI, the School of Communication Information Department, but I'm not going to try to convince them to let me do more work. So, but yeah, he's been a good resource for sure.
When I was looking back on your website again yesterday, prepping for this, and I just wanted to read this quote from you again from, again, a friend, a mentor. It says, Jake Thistle is a star of the future today. His stage presence, vocal abilities, and superb guitar and keyboard skills put him in a league with the best in the business. Jake has carved a path for himself as a true road warrior, a musician worthy of your attention and one to keep an eye on for sure. So being friends with someone like Jeff, who's been around the block and has worked with some of the biggest names, that must mean something when Jeff writes something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's been, you know, I've known him now for, I think, 5 or 6 years. It's been quite a long time. And, you know, I'm always really, really grateful that, you know, he brings me around and everything like that. And I think we've developed a really good, you know, relationship. And I mean, more than anyone, honestly, I've traveled with him, I think, more than any. We do the thing in Gainesville and I've been to L.A. with him. And, you know, we're trying to get some more stuff on the books. And so, you know. It's been a ton of fun. He's a really great resource, and I especially because I love to write. he's a good resource for that too, because I'd love to get into that at some point.
Definitely, yeah. And so talk about that in a little bit, because obviously we're going to get into your album. That's really why I wanted to talk to you mainly today. But talking about the highlights from sort of these last couple of years, or certainly last year especially, going down to Gainesville's a big part of the calendar for any of us Tom Petty fans, and I'm finally going to get to go this year. So I'm really hoping that both you and Jeff are there, because I don't want to be able to get to see you live. So
I am too, yeah. Last I talked to him, I think that's what we're planning on. I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but I plan on it. You know, I haven't, I don't think I'm confirmed for it yet, but I'm sure I will be shortly. I as long as they have me, I always like being down there. And are you going to do shows from down there? That'd be great.
I'm hoping so. Yeah. I'm hoping to get, I've been talking with Dan, the producer. We were going to look at it last year, but it didn't pan out. So I'm hoping that I'll do a Petty trivia, or we'll do a round table, or with a few people. And that'd be kind of, it would be so cool to do that, right? Just to be involved would be so nice.
Yeah, I'm sure he would, you know, it'd be awesome to set up. They have a good space there for like a press area, you know.
Yeah.
On Petty Project next to the Mark Felsot tent and like all this stuff. That we could all just go down the line like a conveyor belt. Yeah. I think that'd be great.
That'd be a great part of the press junket. Oh man, that'd be a dream come true for me. We've also had some other highlights last year. So Americana Song of the Year, the Boulevard
magazine.
And the NJArts.com Brooklyn Can Wait was number 50. I think that was fairly recent in their list of New Jersey-based songs, and it's in there with some pretty big names and some pretty big songs, right?
Yeah, that was very unexpected. So I'm really grateful for that. That came out a couple of days, I think yesterday, 2 days ago.
Yeah.
That's some incredible company. So I was really, really grateful. I think it was in the top 50 of all time songs out of New Jersey.
Yeah.
So I don't know necessarily. I don't know how I feel about that, but I appreciate it.
Well, I think you're too close to it. A lot of the people say that. And I was going to ask that, because I like asking artists this. I asked Jeff this when I spoke to him fairly recently. How do you take when someone says, when you get an award like that, or when you get recognition like that, are you able to take that at face value? Or do you just think, really? Did they mean me? Did they know I'm just kind of this chance? Because I always think that. Do you still have imposter syndrome, or have you kind of got around that a little bit now? Because I think being able to accept compliments is difficult for some people, especially artists, but I think it is an important thing, because when people give you compliments and include you in these lists, they are being sincere, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I think there will always be an inherent level of that, you know, just because even like a song like Brooklyn Can Wait, like I'm so grateful for that response, you know. And of course the first thing I say is kind of like, oh, well, that's kind of strange. I didn't expect that at all. You know, I don't put out these songs thinking, oh, this is going to be the Grammy, you know? But I think there's a lot to be said about the fact that, you know, I wrote that song when I was just like hunched over here at 3 a.m, like exhausted with a cup of coffee, like, let me just write a song. And then I wrote the song the next week when I'm like cutting out all these verses. And, you know, I wrote it when I'm like messing up the bass line in the studio and stuff. Like I've seen all of these like awkward stages of the song. And so I think that kind of trains the artist to sort of go, oh, I don't know why they chose that. But I suppose it's probably a different thing, you know, seeing the finished polished touch.
Yeah.
Just saying, yep, did it in 5 minutes. What are you going to do? I'm great. You know, like that type of thing. I think a lot of the time that sort of attitude is easier said than done, just because we've seen it evolve or not evolve over such a long period of time.
Well, I think that's one thing that I've always sort of, the main parallel I've always drawn between you and Jackson Browne, Tom Petty and those guys is, you know, because obviously you get, there's the similarity in the styles sometimes and a similarity sometimes in your vocals, but it's more that work ethic and getting through the catalogue. I'm just getting into Wildflowers now for this next season. So into the Great Wide Open Wildflowers, it's at that point that Tom, he's not chasing hits anymore, right? I mean, obviously the label's got one eye on that. But Tom's just looking at the song, and he always did sort of, the song is the most important thing. And I always get that sense with you too, that, well, all I have to do is worry about making this next song as good as I can possibly make this next song.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's an incredible way to think. And it's funny, you know, just inherently being a young person doing this, I always get the question of like, what? So, you know, what do you want to do? Like you want to be at the Garden? Like what is your plan? And my answer is always just, to do music in some capacity at some point, support myself, even if it's just on the side, whatever, because I love it and that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
But It is that is a factor I envy a little bit, I have to say, is like that whole like Tom Petty thing at, when he's coming up with Wildflowers or Mojo or like any of these albums that are kind of just like a defining point of like, holy crap, that's what he did. Yep. When he could do anything he wanted because he was Tom Petty and he didn't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
He didn't, you know, and again, I don't know his mental state at the time, but I'm sure, you know, when you're writing, you got to get it. You're going to get it. Like, you have to think, all right, well, I kind of need an American Girl type song on this, right? Because yeah. I would love this record to do that, you know, and I'm, you know, or like even like the Springsteen stuff. I'm a huge fan of the Western Stars album.
Right.
Which is like this great kind of off the beaten path concept album that he did that just kind of blew my mind. But I'm not sure, you know, I don't think he would have been able to do that in the, you know, I think Darkness would have had to come out before yeah. that, Born or Run. So if I was ever able to get to something like that, I think that would be a lot of fun.
Well, it's funny that you brought that up because You're Gonna Get It is obviously the second album in the Heartbreakers catalog. And Tom famously said once that, you know, you get your whole life to write your first album. You get 9 months to write your second one. Right. So you're in that you're in that position where exactly, right? So you've got down the line is your album that you self-produced and wrote and recorded everything yourself. And then obviously I think you probably got some mixing done somewhere else. But going into the studio with a set of songs now where you sign a record contract, and now it's probably a little bit more quote unquote real. It's like, oh man, I think I've got to bring my A game now. So what was the process for, like, how quickly did that set of songs that become The Half Left Out, how quickly did they come together?
I feel like I kind of got a redo of that my whole life thing. Because, right. You know, The Half Left, Down the Line came out in 2020. I was 16 and I had these songs from when I was 14, 15, whatever. Most of them, though, were from that year.
Yeah.
And I just did it in a soundboard. I mixed it myself and I just took out the SD card and put it in the computer. That was it. Like, I didn't use anything. Like, I did it like, I think it was like, I have a talent of finding the hardest way possible to do something. And then 4 years, you know, give or take, 3 years went by. Now I'm working with Golden Retriever Records or whatever. I have these songs over 4, 3, 2 years, whatever.
Right.
Also weren't written for that. It was a lot of them were. But, you know, a lot of those songs are pretty old. The Dreamer, I think, was the oldest one. That was from 2021.
Yeah.
And so it was definitely a little bit more pressure than Down the Line because it was industry-backed and they needed it by a deadline or whatever. But this album that I'm writing now is really the first one where I'm sitting down and go, you know, The Half Left Out came out in November. We're yeah. shooting to be recording the next album, you know, sometime late spring, early summer through, you know, maybe to get it out fall, you know, those are all circumstantial right now. But this is the first time I've really felt that sort of like pit in your stomach of like, all right, I hope I get one today, you know? So I'm excited though. It excites me. I think it's a different way to write.
So, when you get into the studio, then the question, I think I'd asked you this maybe when because obviously I covered it. I did an episode, a non-Petty episode, the only one I've done so far. I'm going to do more of those on Ghosted Road.
Thank
which
you.
I really enjoyed digging into that song at a, you know, that sort of micro level. And you were very gracious to send me some notes back. But when you go in, obviously you've got these songs in either acoustic or piano and some general idea of how you want to arrange them in your head. But how much does the studio and the producer and the musicians you're working with affect and inform how those arrangements develop in the studio?
It's really a big help to get other ears on it. I've always tried to make as elaborate demos as I can. So for most of The Half Left Out, and prior to that, I was doing it on the same soundboard, like the same way I recorded Down the Line. So I didn't have too much flexibility because I can put a guitar track and a vocal track and a bass track, whatever. I can't play drums, you know, whatever it is. I have the sounds that my keyboard has. So, you know, the producer, especially, we worked with two producers on this, Jacob Kulik, and he has with April Rose Gabrielli, they have this producing thing called The Pair. Now they're with Interstate Music. They have a Music Row studio in Nashville. Yeah, it was incredible. I worked with them on the session. We typically did two songs at a time for The Half Left Out. And
right.
We did Ghosted Road, Rolling Away at the same two-day session. And then a year went by. Ghosted Road had already been out. This was July. Ghosted Road came out in December. And then the new year started. And now we're back trying to mix the record. We're in, so I guess we recorded Ghost of the Road July of 22.
Okay. Like
December of 22. Now we're in summer 2023. I've got a bunch of other stuff written and we're recording and Rolling Away. I'm listening to it and Ghost of the Road had already been out, but I just wasn't happy with it. I don't know. It didn't fit. I thought it was kind of 70s in a bad way, you know, which is not something I think 70s is a good way, but I don't know. I'll set it to you. You'll have to let me know what you think.
Yeah, anyway, sure.
So they were living in Pennsylvania and we recorded in Asbury Park, New Jersey. And, we were talking, this might've been Thursday or something. Hey, yep. You know, I'm going to redo Rolling Away. We're going to go, all right, I'll come to your place in Pennsylvania. So then I get a call on like that Saturday or something. And we were supposed to do this on Tuesday. And he's like, hey, last minute, we moved to Nashville. It's a great opportunity. So he's like, we can leave like one mic at the old place if you want and, you know, do it there. I'm like, no, I'm going to come to Nashville. Are you crazy? I've always wanted to get there. So that was my first time in Nashville. And it was such a blast to just, they brought me around town and they were very, very gracious hosts. But yeah, so that we did Rolling Away twice. And the second time, the one that's on the record was from Nashville.
It's really interesting.
Thank you. I thought so too. I was hoping a label would think the same thing when they were sending me to Nashville, but they liked it too. That was good. And then the other producer who produced the other five on the record was Tyler Sarfet. And he was really a huge help in kind of developing that sound. That I think the album turned into. He's really the first one that introduced me to, you know, that kind of like synthesizer-y pad, yep, swirl atmospheric stuff. And that was something I always liked, but was a little too ambitious for me to figure out on my own. Yep. So I'm really grateful for all the work he put into that. And now that we've done it, I've since then gotten smarter and I've bought Logic and I'm now making demos for real in the computer and I'm adding all of those components in. So the demos for the new album are far more intricate than anything I've ever done, but I'm sure I haven't sent them to any producers yet, but once I do, I'm sure they will also put a really cool spin on it that I can't even imagine as we're talking now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the process though, right? But it's interesting to me that, so Brooklyn Can Wait then and Rolling Away were different producers in different locations, because I was going to make a comment on this one. We're going to dig into the songs, hopefully, that those two bookend this set of songs just superbly, and they kind of feel of a piece. They match sonically. There's a sort of through line between both of them. So the fact that they were recorded at different times in different locations, that's, like I said, that's really interesting to me. That you still got that cohesion out of a process like that that's a little bit more fragmented.
I appreciate you saying that, because that was kind of on purpose. You know, when I recorded... the timeline for everything, we did Ghosted Road in July of 22.
Yeah.
And then The Dreamer, Keeping It Alive in December of 22. And then we did Brooklyn Can Wait in June of 23. Rolling Away in August of 23. And then Brain Freeze and Half Beats Nothing in September of 23.
Okay.
So I had all the songs written and I was really trying, even though I hadn't recorded them yet, I was still trying to sequence the record. And that's something I'm always intimidated by, but also care extremely about. I kind of wanted Rolling Away to be last, but I didn't think what we had, I mean, it's fine for an album track, what we had originally. I mean, I was very proud of it at the time and I still think it's cool. I'm sure it'll be put out sometime, but, I just didn't think it was a closer on the record. And I didn't think it, having heard what ended up being Brooklyn Can Wait and knowing that that was going to probably start the record, I wanted something that fit a little better and kind of made it full circle and everything.
Yeah.
The original Rolling Away we recorded with the full band.
Okay.
You know, was Ghosted Road, Rolling Away, the OG Rolling Away, and then The Dreamer and Keeping It Alive. We recorded full band in the studio. Me on vocals and guitar, a lead guitar player, a bass player, and a drummer. But the other three was just me and Tyler. Me and Jake Kulik, you know, down in Nashville for Rolling Away, and April Rose Gabrielli. And the other one's just me and Tyler sitting in the studio, like trying out different basses and synthesizers and stuff. And those are some of my favorite songs. I play with all those musicians, the band that we still play, and that's like my general touring band these days. And they're really, really great. It had nothing to do with them and their playing, but I really liked being able to fine tune everything on our own, as opposed to just hitting record and hoping for the best.
Well, I mean, a great album should have a great closer, and it is important, that stuff, right? And it's kind of cool that, again, I mean, I don't always like leaning into the fact that you are pretty young still, but to have that ear still to say, you know what, it's good enough, but maybe good enough isn't quite, maybe that's not enough. Maybe I can make it better. So having that sort of presence and wherewithal to say, let's just rethink this and re-go back and redo this, I think that shows, and I mean, it's nice too that you've got a label who would be open to that, right? Because obviously you've spent a bit of money already recording it once.
Yeah.
So wanting to go and do it again, well, you know, there's a bit of trust there that you need from the people who are paying the money, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was really hoping they'd go for it. You know, when we went, the first time I met with my label, which I guess was January of 22, the head of my label, Joe Riccatelli, he was at RCA. He was president over there for a little bit. And then, you know, he formed Retriever Records, you know, and then, you know, eventually he, you know, he stepped down from that because he didn't want to send a million emails a day and, you know, work at, you know, such high up at Sony Music and everything. So he was just running Golden Retriever. We have a mutual friend, Tom Cunningham, who hosts Springsteen on Sundays on One-on-One The Boss, you know, here in Jersey. And I was on his show and Joe had heard me on that. And that's how we met. And I met with him in his office and I, you know, I brought my acoustic and I played him Ghosted Road and Rolling Away were the first two that I played him. And immediately we decided Rolling Away was going to be the first single that I put out. And, you know, and we went in the studio thinking that, but we left the studio thinking it was going to be Ghosted Road.
Yeah.
So I'd already known, at least, not that they were disappointed, but that his expectations were at least subverted to a different song. So I went into it kind of hoping he'd remember that. You know, remember this song you thought would be a single, but we didn't think it was, you know, we thought Ghosted Road was better. You know, just because by nature, I mean, the first time I played him Rolling Away, it was like 6.5 minutes long. It was like a long song. I cut out 3 verses and 2 bridges. but eventually, once I cut it down and we were working on it, Rolling Away has a kind of a catchier, shorter chorus, and it's like 3.5 minutes. On the record, it's like 2-something because we sped it up like crazy. But the original
one
faster, was slower. So it was like, you know, 3:30, whatever. And Ghosted Road has a longer chorus and more of a windy structure, and it's like 4.5 minutes. So we always assumed that Rolling Away was going to be the single. So when we switched to Ghosted Road, I kind of banked on them remembering that and being like, all right, remember, let's just do this for real.
That's super cool. I mean, you talk about sequencing being important, and I totally agree with that. I think single release schedule or whatever you want, the sequence you do that, it is also important. I think that Ghosted Road is the natural first single off this album. Even though Brooklyn Can Wait opens it, there's something that's just a bit more, I think if people are fans of Jake Thistle, Ghosted Road's easy, right? That's like, okay, I'm in safe territory here. This sounds like Jake. He's not taking me too far into any sort of area. While it's this a great song, and I mean, I love the push on the chorus, the big stop, and then Stay is just, I told you that, I just love that break. But let's get into the songs here then. Brooklyn Can Wait is, you know, when you released that one, because I think it was Ghosted Road first, The Dream is second, and then Brooklyn Can Wait was the third single, right?
Yeah.
And it blew my legs off. I was like, what the, are you kidding me? Like, because I thought Ghosted Road, that's going to be, you know, from the outside, well, that's going to be the strongest song because it's the lead single. It's great. I love it. The instrumentation's great. Brooklyn Can Wait comes out. I was like, oh, no, hang on a minute. This is something completely different now. And so I was wondering about the sort of the origins of that song, how it started and how that grew, because the arrangement you end up with, like you said, with those big synth pads, isn't something that you were going to have done on the demo, I'm assuming.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. The original plan, you know how you mentioned it, you know, the first one sounds like Jake, and then I slowly kind of build up to like a different sound.
Yeah.
I wish I could say that was on purpose, but really that was just me trying to talk myself into it as well. I came in the studio, you know, and these days when I look back at it, it's so funny, but, you know, kind of nervous. I was like, okay, I'm working with a label and like, I don't want them to turn me into like a, not that they would have, but a dance, you know, microphone on my ear and like, you know, doing backflips, like just, you know, like Justin Timberlake or something. And I was worried about that. I don't really know why. And I was working, you know, with Jake and that was great. His music is a little more pop than mine. He is a, you know, his music is under Kulik. He's a great writer. And then when we did The Dreamer and Keeping It Alive, we used Tyler, who is much more of a pop mind than me.
Right.
But we went in with the full band, and you know, he did a great job. But we really kept him reined into like the Ghosted Road sound and a little more of like rock and trying to keep it like that. And we went in with the full band. We had rehearsed a bunch, so we just came in, knew our parts, and did it. So there was not even that much to talk about, really. So he did a great job. But I remember the owner of the studio, John Liedersdorf, who's an awesome guy. He's one of the coolest guys in the area. You know, he had said, "Oh, I love what you did with Tyler." I didn't think that's what Tyler, you know, would have done with you. That was pretty cool. And I said, "Oh yeah, well, we brought the band." He's like, "You should just see what happens if you let Tyler be Tyler. You know, Right. Don't the band, whatever." And I said, "Oh, yeah, okay." I didn't know what I was going to give him, but it ended up the next song was Brooklyn Can Wait. And yeah, I wrote Brooklyn Can Wait, I think, was the last one I wrote for the record. So we were supposed to, the next single was going to be Brain Freeze. We hadn't recorded it yet, but just in the writing pattern, that's what we figured would be next.
Right.
And it was going to be a little weird because it was going to be the summer and, you know, Brain Freeze. Like, we didn't know how we were going to, like, angle it. And I wrote Brooklyn Can Wait in, I think, March or April, you know, of 23. And immediately my label just kind of really was turned on to it and said, all right, that's going to be next. And that's the only song we did in a one-day session. Everything else, we did two songs over 2 days. But Brooklyn Can Wait, we said, let's just do this as a standalone session. Let's not put a B-side on it. So we just went in, you know, I don't know, 10 a.m. and had it by 7 or 8. But it was just me. It was the first time I'd ever worked with just me and a producer.
Right.
No band. I did the, you know, he's a great drummer, Tyler. So they are real drums. You know, a lot of that Half Beats Nothing, Brain Freeze not so much, but Half Beats Nothing and Brooklyn Can Wait, people often think they're machines or you know, like Logic percussion. And there is a lot of that in there too.
Yeah.
But he played all those drum parts mostly. And I mean, I was so happy with how he played it. But yeah, Brooklyn Can Wait was weird. I wrote it in one take, basically. Like, it was kind of like that sort of Wildflowers thing, you know, where he kind of just like said whatever the hell and it ended up being Wildflowers. Like, that's kind of how it happened. I was sitting at the piano. I mean, it sounded different. It was slower and sort of swung, like,
Right.
But the lyrically, I ended up cutting a lot, but about 98% of the words that are in there were from just that first voice memo of me kind of just looking around the room and saying whatever, which doesn't really happen to me usually.
Yeah.
You know, like Lines on the Road I wrote, which is from Down the Line, I wrote that in like 8 or 9 months. Like if it doesn't happen in 10 minutes, it's not happening for 5 months, for better or worse. So Brooklyn Can Wait was just a quick one. And, you know, it had seen a lot of evolution since then, and I cut a lot out. Some of the original kind of gimmicks of the song I ended up taking out. Originally, every verse was going to end with, like, a classic American novel, which is why the first verse ends with "The Postman Always Rings Twice." That one I just kept. I just thought that fit.
Yeah.
But I was also going to talk. I forget what the other ones were. "The Sun Also Rises" was definitely in there because that rhymes with rise.
Yeah.
I forget what the other ones were, but you know, so I took that to the label. They immediately liked it, and that's why they said, "Let's just do this next." And ended up, you know, streaming the best by far. You know, I think that one sits at like 62,000, something like that, and then the others are like, you know, 30. You know.
Oh yeah, you're way up there. I mean, it's funny now that I know that, now that you said that it came quickly. I think that's why the lyrics have the charm that they do then. It's because they're not poured over in a good way, right? Where you're not second guessing it. You're trusting that instinct. Because I know last time I spoke to you, I remember you telling me that you tend to overwrite and you write lots and lots in that and then pair it back. But it's better to do that than not to have any ideas.
Yeah.
But I mean, for me, the whole hook in that song is that vocal melody line. So how quickly did that motif come? Because once you've got that, I think it's one of those little things when you write a song, you think, yeah, there's something here. That works. I can hang everything else around that and build out from that.
Yeah, that was something I had that, you know, sort of chord progression for a while.
Yeah.
That wasn't new. I just couldn't, but it sounded different. You know, it didn't sound like how it ended up being. And I couldn't figure out what to really do. And then I just started like humming melodies and trying different stuff. And then, you know, I tend to just say random words a lot, you know, like usually I say the sentence, like I usually say, I don't know what I'm doing. It's like what I typically say, but for whatever reason, this time I just said, check the mail, go outside. And like, I was like, all right. And I just started writing it. And then I started the thing. And you know, I had been looking to write, Brooklyn just seemed like a, you know, I like being there. It's kind of right around the corner. So it just seemed like a good thing to say. It the syllables are needed. Manhattan had an extra syllable and Queen one too little. And so it just ended up being that. There's no real super deeper meaning other than the fact that I think Brooklyn is such an interesting and vibrant place just in terms of how it's, you know, coming up again and, you know, the way it's kind of bustling now.
Well, I think too, though, that there's a danger always when you start using Brooklyn or California or where it can feel a bit contrived, but because you're, you know, that's where you're from and you know it, then it just, it's believable when you sing it. If I wrote a song about Brooklyn, I can't sell that, right? Because I'm from Wigan. I'm from a coal mine inside of the Northwest. I think everyone's going to say, "He's talking about you, Eddie. You can't sing about Brooklyn," right? But because you do it, there's that authenticity to it that carries it. But let's talk a little bit of the video too, because obviously we're talking about Brooklyn, the shots are at Brooklyn. So what incredible casting to find this actress who can convey this. She's got this youthful vulnerability, but there's that undercurrent of sort of optimism and there's a quiet strength to her that match that optimism and that sort of the lilt of the song. So how involved in the video were you? Was that sort of pitched to you or did you have some sort of creative input and storyboarding, that kind of thing?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I you know, she was great. That's Bernie Reich. She was through the label. She was a mutual friend of Joe's somehow, and she was studying in New York. So it was just a good natural fit. Typically for the videos, we'll get a director for it or whatever, and I'll just say, you know, they'll ask me. I say, I don't care. Do what you want, but then let me see it before we do it.
Yeah,
because I don't have a good. I guess like maybe I have a good eye for that. I really don't even know. But I found I'd rather be writing the next song than like sitting there like, all right, like, are we going to be on the bridge? And okay, now we're going to be in a coffee shop and like, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just not, I don't know if it's not how I think, but it's just not how I choose to, I guess. I don't know. And I know very well that whoever we hire to do it is going to do a better job than me anyway. So we may let them get the first crack at it. But I was pretty vocal about wanting to do something different than The Dreamer, which is a video where I'm just kind of traipsing around Montclair lip syncing, which was great. And that director did a great job too. I'm not putting it down, but I just felt like I'd done it and it was good. It was fine. Yeah. And in the same sense, the Ghosted Road video was different from that. You know, that was like in the studio and all intercut. So I wanted to do something different again.
Yeah.
And I just thought it'd be cool to, I thought it was a cool idea to have me play all of these unrelated extras.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like what, I don't know, have you ever seen the show Scrubs?
Yes. Yep.
So I was kind of thinking about it like the Colin Hay episode.
Okay.
He's like playing overkill on the bench and JD's like, oh, what? And then like he's in the morgue, you know, playing it. And like,
yeah,
I get maybe they're the same guy, maybe they're not. Like I have to rewatch the episode. But that was kind of what I was thinking. And I wanted to do something like that. So that's why, you know, I'm the busker in the subway and I'm the guy that's getting his hair cut and everything like that. I don't know if everybody got that. Just having talked to some people, holding everybody understood that was what was happening, but that was my intent. And the director for that was the same guy, Johnny Cervais, who he was also the videographer for Ghosted Road.
Okay.
And he, you know, he put it together. I guess he was the director. We hired him to, you know, just shoot some of that Ghosted Road session when we were there and it turned into the video. I don't know if that was the initial plan, but...
Right.
It probably was, and I just don't remember. But and he did a great job. That was a lot of fun.
Well, the Ghosted Road video is great too because you all look so relaxed, right? I mean, those behind the scenes things too, especially for nerds and fans. It's like, you want to kind of, what instrument is that? Oh, look at that guitar there. How's this drum set up? Like, what's, you know? So getting to see that is kind of cool. But what I love about the video for Brooklyn is because And again, I don't know how much this is deliberate time, which, because we sort of backfill meaning into things all the time, right? But because she's on her own in that, you don't really see her interacting with anyone in the relationship. She's on her own, like she's alone, right? And that's that whole thing. And like I said, I think I posted on your YouTube channel that the line that just kills me in that song is, you can move away from home, but it'll miss you. And to have that, have her isolated in that way kind of punches that home. Like I said, because I mean, I moved out of home when I was 16. I joined the army. And then I moved away from home again and moved to continent and moved to Canada. So you can move away from home, but it'll miss you, really, really resonates with me, because you sort of, when you move, you think about it selfishly. You think, well, I miss home. I miss my mom. I miss this. I miss that. But you forget also that there are people and there are reasons why they might miss you. So that, like I said, man, it's such a good line. There's always one. You're like Petty in that way as well, right? There's always one line in every song. I'm like, God damn, I wish I'd written that. That's so good. And that's the line in this song.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Yeah, you know, it was deliberate. I was really careful when I was writing the song to not, I didn't want it to be a love story.
Yeah.
And I'm sure in some of the verses I cut out that there were more elements to that, just because I think that's just, you know, you've written, like, you know, any songwriter, like,
yeah,
whatever. The easiest way to add depth to a song is to just say what you want to say and then add "with you" at the end. You know, like, so... I was trying to avoid that. And I think I was happy with how it was avoided. You know, I'm talking to someone. I didn't, you know, it's not a girl. It's not a boy. It's just like a thing. It's whatever. But when we started talking about the video and having a girl in the video, I wanted to reiterate that point, because also I've never had a video with a girl in it. And like,
yeah,
I think it'd be really easy to draw that conclusion, is that, okay, it's a, you know, Jake's in the video, but girl's in the video, whatever. It's a lot. So I was really trying to make sure that it was like, you know, because I don't consider myself, I'm not Jake. You know, I know I'm a really good actor in that video. And clearly I'm all these people, but, you know, I'm just like, I'm haircut guy one, busker guy one, whatever. I'm not a part of the video.
Yeah.
I'm just the guy that was in it because I was saying it, you know? So I was really careful to have it not be a love story. You know, maybe it's a love story with moving away or something, but I didn't want it to be like boy, girl, like come to Brooklyn. I'm in Brooklyn. I miss you. You know,
yeah.
That was, so I wanted to make sure the video also portrayed that.
But that's what good songwriters do too, though, is they have universality about their songs that people can insert themselves into, right? So
yeah.
If that
yeah.
resonates as a love song for someone, well then great. That's awesome. If that's right. how you interpret it, brilliant, you know?
Exactly. That's why I didn't want to stamp it on, because
yeah.
you know, then there are people that it wouldn't resonate with. So I just wanted to yeah. make it, you know, however that home missing you is how you decide that it does, right? That's yeah. all in your head, because it's a, you know, home is a concept. So
absolutely.
You know, I figured I want to leave that to them and not have it be, you know, so trite.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's Keeping It Alive is the second track on the album. And this is one that is funny again, because when I went back and I was like, oh, The Dream was is the oldest song out of this set of songs. But Keeping It Alive is the one that I think, to me, feels the closest to Down the Line era, Jake Thistle. It's got similar bones. It's got a similar flow to it, some of those songs. But I also noticed that, because the demo that you've got on YouTube, you pitched up, I think, right? Did you step, you pitched up a full step, I think, in the recording.
Keeping It Alive has had so many keys.
Okay.
Yeah. I wrote it in C, I think.
Okay.
Finally, we landed in B flat for the record.
Yeah.
There's probably YouTube videos of me in A.
I think it's, yeah, you're in A flat or something because you're capoed, right?
Okay. Then, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Especially in those early days when I, you know, that kind of weird 2020 and 2021 are like weird years for my songwriting, because like Down the Line had come out. I didn't have a record contract. I didn't know what was coming. So yeah. like when I was putting up videos, I would just like haphazardly throw a capo on whatever fret and play it in whatever position. And, you know, so I'm sure. Yeah, most of these songs have seen a lot of key changes, especially Keeping It Alive. Keeping It Alive and The Dreamer.
Okay.
Which is funny because they were in the same session. But they're the two oldest. But Keeping It Alive has seen a lot of edits. I don't know all of them are even up on YouTube, but I'm sure you could find versions where there's a lot of different lyrics and replaced verses and things like that. I'd kind of sat on that song for a while.
So here's the question then for you, because I love asking people about that, because I love process, right? The process of writing songs, that's what gets me off. But when do you know when you found the right key then? Is there something where you think, my voice is right there, or there's some harmonic thing that happens between the piano and the guitar, or does the producer just say, I think your voice sounds better there? What's usually the determining factor on that?
You know, for Keeping It Alive, now I'm trying to think. Okay. I remember now. I wrote Keeping It Alive in G.
Oh, okay.
A long, long time ago. And it probably had a different melody. And I remember specifically writing that song, and I was starting it on, you know, the five is kind of where the melody kind of swings back around in the verses. And I was playing it like as a C chord up two frets.
Okay.
With the open G ringing. So it was kind of like a sus. And I just thought that was like a cool sound. I hadn't really started a song on the five. I usually start them on the four. So I thought it'd be interesting and different. So that's how I wrote the song, you know, at least the chords for the song.
Yeah.
And then I'm glad you asked that about this song, because I wouldn't be able to, I don't know why I remember this so well. It's probably the only one I could tell you exactly what I was thinking. But, I was writing it, and, you know, after a D, okay, and you go to the E minor, whatever. And then I started writing the lyrics, and then at some point I just decided, all right, the key has to change. It needs to sound better or whatever.
Right.
And so because I was younger, I think I moved it to C, because that's just where it fit nicely in my voice. And then 3 years passed, and, you know, I wasn't 15, I was 18, whatever, and then B-flat made the most sense. So that's probably how it happened. But in general, I really don't know. I usually start with the chords.
Okay.
And then from the chords, I'll pick up a melody. So really, I just... whatever chords I have picked, I just fit a melody in that, you know? So like if I decide capo 3 C, you know, E flat works for me.
Yeah.
Then I'm just going to sing a melody that sounds good at E flat, because I've already been writing in E flat. And then when it's done, if I say, you know what, I could really blow this out and just make it huge, maybe I'll move it to F.
Right.
Or something, or vice versa. Like when we did Brooklyn Can Wait, I wrote that song in E flat.
Okay.
And now the record version is in C sharp or D flat. So I was writing it in E flat, and I still think it sounds really good, but because it was higher in my voice, it was a little poppy and bubbly, and
yeah,
that worked with the piano demo because it was kind of swung and bouncy and anything. But when I started tuning my guitar down and playing it in open tuning with just downbeats and straight eighths, I decided a little bit darker worked. So I moved it to D, you know, which is a half step.
Yeah.
And then when I realized, because D flat is too low.
Right.
Still, like when I play it live, I do it in D. But I knew in the studio, the way we record the vocals, I could really lock in. It's just that way.
It's low, man. It's hard.
It's pretty low.
It's hard to control that because people don't know that. It's easy to push air at the top end of your range. Because it's easy to control that. When you're down at that, it's harder to get that to sound good. Yeah, totally.
So when I was in the studio, I realized we can control that a little more. I can do it 1,000 times till I get it right.
Yeah.
And also, I can sing it as low as I, you know, as volume-wise, as quiet as I want.
Yeah.
And they can just pump it full of compression and gain and get it to where it needed to. Tyler's a great producer. He'll figure it out. That was kind of my thought. I said, let me just lower one more key, because then I can keep it kind of dense and dark, which is what I wanted to, you know.
Yeah. So Keeping It Alive, but the other thing I've noted was there's a really nice turnaround. There's a push in the turnaround coming out of the second chorus and into that next verse with the piano, bass, and drums that's not there. And again, it's not there in the demo. So that's, again, you know, when you listen back to those demos, and I'm always like, well, that's not there. He didn't have that there. So I always kind of think, I wonder if that was just spontaneous in the studio or whether that was worked up. But then it's also... we get that drop out of the drums in the last verse, and there's some slide guitar in there. And I was curious, did you play that slide guitar part?
I did.
Or was that your...
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay.
That was planned, that turnaround.
Okay.
Original demo, everything was going back to one. you know? So the intro, just like four bars of one, and then, you know, yeah, I'm keeping it alive, right on the resolution one and whatever. I just didn't, I thought it was, I didn't think it was me, because I suppose it's like petty, but like I'm not a big fan of ending on the one or starting on the one. Like I love a good four chord. So I started sitting at the piano and saying, all right, what can I do with this? And eventually I kind of came onto that 4-5, 4-5, 4-5 thing. And I, you know, in addition, there was no bridge in the original song. I don't know if you heard that in the demo. I don't know how old that demo was, but I'm sure there's versions. It was just two more verses that I ended up. And so when I wrote that bridge, which is just kind of like rewrite to the first and second verse, like said a little bit of a different way, it's 6-5-1-4. And I thought if I take out the one of the intro and the turnarounds, it makes it really interesting that the only one in the entire song is a passing chord in the bridge. I just thought like, that's really weird. So am I going to end it up working? So yeah. And then the lap steel, that's a Duesenberg lap steel.
Oh, nice.
That has the benders on it. I was, Ron Blair has one, and I was playing with him in LA, and he was like showing me a little bit on it, and I was saying like, oh yeah, I don't know how to play lap steel, so, and I mean, it's a Duesenberg, right? So it's not cheap. And so I said, I'll probably get like, you know, one of those $200 lap steels and like learn it. And he goes, no, don't do that, because you're going to get the $200 lap steel, learn it, and then you're going to buy this anyway. So if you're worried about, I don't remember how much I got a really good deal on it, but like typically, you know, he's like, he just said, you know, would you rather spend $2,000 or $2,000 and $200? You know, just buy the next one and learn on that, because you're going to want it anyway. So I took his advice and we brought it to the studio and that was cool. I would, every time I'm better at lap steel now than I was then. But other than that, you know, but I think mixed in really cool.
It's a great instrument. I got it from my best friend who does all the music for this podcast. He sits down when he plays lap steel, or he plays just to play his lap acoustic or slide acoustics. Like, man, there's just something about that sound.
Absolutely.
That I dig. But you're talking about song structure then and mess around. And that's the stuff that I think it's cool for us. If you're a musician here, you think, I see what he's done there. That's really clever. But for if you've not got that musical ear, there's still something about that song then that's interested. You know, you don't know what it is and you couldn't articulate what it is. But it's not just that straightforward. And Brain Freeze is another one that I thought has a really cool structure, because you're kind of messing around. You don't know where 4 is ever really in that song. And it's in, I think it's in 2-4 rather than 4-4. You know, it's
better than me.
It's this weird sort of, it's an odd one. It's right. And it was one of the ones where I thought straight away, like, I like this song. This is another one that was like, I get what this is. I'm totally on board with this. It's a really strong piece of writing. I loved it instantly, man.
Thank you. Yeah. That song, it's funny with that song. In general, I write a lot of bars of 2.
Right.
I did it on Down the Line because I didn't know how music worked and I didn't know how to count. And like, I just wrote and I played to a click, but it wasn't like a 4 click. It was just like, you know, whatever. And I didn't realize. But then as I started to get older and I understood that, I found myself not wanting to avoid it, because it's just now that's how I sound and I really like it. I think it's interesting. So I still write like that. I just understand that I'm doing it a little better. And so with Brain Freeze, it was really funny because in addition to that, there's two drummers basically. I mean, it's Tyler both times, but you know, I wanted the train track brushes, but we did it like that. And this isn't even in the studio. This is just, I played it live with my band a whole bunch before we'd gone in, because now I've had the band for a while and I was taking it out places. And I just was getting so bored. It's not a short song, but I remember just thinking like, all right, like I'm kind of over it. And I didn't think that was, obviously that's not a good thing to be thinking about the song you're having as your next single. So I had him doing like, you know, the brushes, and then he came back in and just did like a big tom thing.
Yeah.
You know, 1 and 2, 2. You know, you're a drummer, you know better than me.
Yeah.
But you know what he's doing. And he knows what he's doing, and that's all that matters. And so I think that kind of trends into the craziness of that track. It is a little cacophonous, but I like it.
But it Again, I think it's because it's, and I think, like I said, I think it's 2-4. I mean, 2-4 and 4-4 really is 6-1 after the other, obviously. But I think because it's got that to it, it moves around a lot. Like, it's wrestling. It's a wrestler song, right? It doesn't sit in any one place. Like I said, that's where you can't really count four bars in it very easily because you're not going back. You're not resolving down to the root on the one or the four every time. Like, it's this thing that's it's fluid. And again, it just makes it really, really interesting. And again, you know, I'm fading by degrees. Just another great line. They just seem to fall out of you. It's frustrating because...
Well, I stole that.
Where's that from?
That's from Saving Grace.
Oh, of course, Saving Grace. Good grief.
But here's the funny thing. Here's the funny thing. I've always liked that line. But, you know, I'm not a big... I don't like to steal entire lines.
Yeah.
You know, I steal ideas. I steal lines from books. Because it's like, no one will find that. It's in 200 pages. But, you know, in a song, whatever. But then the Lumineers put out an album. And I know they opened for Tom a couple times, I think, and they put out a cover of Walls and stuff. So I know they're Petty fans.
Yeah.
And they had I forget what the song was now, but they have a line, Fading by Degrees. And I hadn't really heard of that other than in Tom's song.
Yeah.
And so I just thought, like, oh, well, hell, if they're going to take it, I'm going to take it. So I stole it from Tom, but kind of with...
By the Lumineers.
The Lumineers broke the ice, and they took it first. So that's how that worked out.
It's amazing that I don't know how I never caught that. That's because Saving Grace is, I mean, I've talked about that song lots with people I have on the episodes, and it's like, why did I never notice that? But I have a question on, so I don't like the way you, what's the next word? Is it leave? And then it's not what I mean when you sing that piece. It's almost like a call and response.
Yeah.
I don't.
So it's I can see every word I say.
Yeah.
As it fogs up the cold from my mouth.
Yeah.
But I don't like the way it reads.
It reads. Okay, I couldn't quite get the... And I threw it into Fader to take the stems out to see if I get the vocal isolated. Still couldn't quite hear it, but cool. But I like that bit too, because that, again, it's got almost that call and response thing to it, just the way your dynamics are on the vocal. So again, all those little production choices, again, I mean, you know, as someone who sort of sits and overanalyzes songs, I'm always looking for that attention to detail, and there's lots of it in that song.
Thank you. Yeah, I think part of the reason it moves around so much is because I'm in a really weird tuning, and when I wrote it, at least, it wasn't a tuning I was super familiar with. So I was just kind of like strumming really fast and trying to put, you know, the reason I wrote the song is the tuning, it's open A, but it's kind of an inverted open A. So it's, what is it? It's E, A, oh crap, let me look at the piano. It's E, A, C sharp, E, A, no. Any A, C sharp, E, A, C sharp.
Warning old.
And that's the tuning, that could be wrong, but that's the tuning that Dylan uses on the original acoustic version of One Too Many Mornings.
Didn't know that.
And he capos it 3rd fret C. And so I was playing that song and I wanted to take it live, you know, play it out live. But it's not a tuning you can just slide into. In open G, you just drop two strings and you're fine.
Yeah.
But I couldn't justify bringing out a guitar tuned like that for one song.
Right.
So I just wrote a song in that tuning. So that's how that happened.
Man, that's fun. You know, because everyone, you know, crowds up and down the world, all over the world, love waiting for the guitarist to tune their damn guitar, right? You know, there's nothing better than watching someone tune up for 15 minutes, like...
Right.
Just have an extra guitar there. It's fine. Yeah. You've got 50. We all know guitarists all have 50 guitars. Just bring an extra one.
So. Right. Exactly. So I figured if I could bank two songs.
Yeah.
Ironically, after that, I've never played the Dylan song again. So now I'm just bringing it one for one song again. But, oh, well.
Well, that's where people... And that's where, you know, when you adapt songs live quite often, then people will just change, you know, the position of the chords, or they'll change the phrasing a little bit, and it changes the, you know, because sometimes when you hear a song live, you think there's something about that that doesn't sound quite the same as it does on the album.
Yeah.
And because it's not capoed, or it's not, there's some kind of different, they're using different positions in the chord. So
yeah, sometimes I play it, like when I have to, I play it capo 4th fret in G standard.
Okay.
But it just doesn't, it's not the same.
Yeah.
There's something about the way the strings ring in that weird tuning, because it's like not, it rings like an open D tuning, which I use a lot, but it's just, they're different intervals. So it sounds weird and I like it. You know, it's good for that song.
I gotta write another one in that tuning so I can break it out.
Gives it its own personality though, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Ghosted Road, like I said, I mean, obviously when that came out, I think December 16th, 2022, right, was when that came out.
Yeah.
But that's the big, like I said, that's if Jake Thistle's going into the studio, that's kind of what I'm waiting for to come out the other end. And that's what I'm hoping for, and that's what we got. And it said, like, digging into that song, the drums on that record, I mean, the whole record, the drums on this are great, but the drums on Ghosted Road, I just love. They sound fantastic. That snare sounds great. There's great definition in the low end with the kick and everything. So I was a big fan of just how that song sounds. But you told me that, when I sort of asked you about that, the Ghosted Road, that phrase was the last part of that song that fell into place, right? You kind of had everything else, but you couldn't quite.
I'm just a lonely soul.
It's Hey Indiana Girl, right? You know, it just doesn't work. I need something different, or it's you rock me. No, it's not good enough. I need something else. And,
exactly. Yeah. It didn't say anything. Yeah. Okay, what does that mean? You're sad sack? That's nothing new in my songs. Every song is just, I'm a sad sack. So I wanted to just say something a little different. And, you know, everything else talked about the roads. So yeah. I think, like, it's got to be something like that. I mean, you know, and that's just what kind of came out. I still don't necessarily know what it means, but no, I think it works. I think it's an image.
For sure. And that is something that you deliberately or intuitively have, is that ability to write visually, sort of cinematically. You give us sort of pictures, like Tom did, right? You've got these things where you can say, I see something when I listen to this. Like when I listen to Love Is a Long Road, I just see the Pacific Coast Highway, right? You just see a top down. Yeah. You just see that in your head. Ghosted Road, you get this, I get back streets, I get sort of, you know, upstate New York, or I get Vermont or something like those big pine trees and all this kind of stuff. So I've got that visual. But again, I mean, another line in this song, your tears meant nothing next to what your silence said. My God, how do you write this at 17, 18? It's ridiculous. Because it's like, I've written down three words. It's negation, ending, finality is what that is. It's sort of the end, you know, once you get to that point, then it's done. It's over at that point, right?
So thank you. I can't take credit for that song because I wrote it on the 64 Tysco that Campbell sent me.
Okay.
And I think it was just the mojo from the guitar. Like, I can't take it's not my hand that wrote that song. That was like, I don't know, like whatever Mike played on that in 1972 that no one remembers, you know, he can't. That's what wrote that song. It's just that guitar and mojo. That's what I'll plead.
I've talked to people about that before too, because there's, you know, the famous piano at Abbey Road that Let It Be was played on, and then a million songs have been played on that. I think that when you sit down with an instrument like that or behind the keyboard or something like that, I'm not a believer in sort of, you know, spirits and those kind of things, but there's something about that though that's going to change your responsibility to the instrument, maybe, right? Where you think, well, Mike Campbell gave me this guitar, I didn't make good use of it then, so maybe I'll lock in a little bit further than I would ordinarily. That's where I always kind of take an angle on that, you know? I don't think it's coming out of the guitar. I think you're putting into the guitar what you think it needs.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you putting the glory back.
You wrote the song, man. I mean, yeah. And I said, like, you know, the stay, the big punch on stay, and then when you don't do it in the last chorus, again, it's just a wonderful bit of a range, and it just keeps that song moving along, because too many songs just keep going, and, you know, the chorus is sung exactly the same way. This is the way the verse is sung. I do another podcast with a friend on, we just finished covering 90s era Metallica. Metallica do a lot of the same thing over and over and over again. There's not as much movement. So I always like it when, again, always the Tom Petty project, I don't feel bad about keep bringing him up, but that's what Tom and Mike always did a good job of, is just changing. It's just that little melody line, or they'll drop this out, or they'll put a suspended chord in there or something just to change it just that little bit. And those little things in this song, again, just sort of, they make me happy, you know. So
I try to be really careful. I don't like to fly anything in the studio, you know. I think there's a lot of merit to the folks that'll, you know, sing a chorus and then they just copy paste it three times. I think there's a time and a place to do that.
But I
don't like doing that, especially on a song like Ghosted Road, just because it's that is kind of a bar band song anyway,
right?
You know, like, it could have, we didn't do it on Brooklyn Can Wait, but like, it could have worked a little more on that song, you know, because that's a little bit more of a factory, you know, in terms of how the vocals are produced and stuff.
Right.
I think Wicked Road called for a little bit more of a rawness, and, you know, maybe I'm a little sharp here, a little flat there, whatever. I think it kind of fit the song.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. Half Beats Nothing.
All right.
It reminds me a little bit, just in sort of, in spirit of Time to Move On. And I think it's maybe just, it's the tempo. It's not quite a shuffle, but it has a little of that. And it's got that big ethereal, again, it doesn't resolve down to the root always exactly where you expect it to be. And it's a big arrangement on this one.
Yeah. This is my favorite one on the record.
Okay.
I don't know why, but that's always the joke I make with my label is because they know, you know, my taste in like Tom Petty and Springsteen and everything. And they know that I always like the deep cuts. So it doesn't surprise me that this was not offered up as a single at any point. But it's my favorite. I don't know. I really like it. And I appreciate that comparison. This is another one that saw a lot of different arrangements, especially in the strumming pattern and the speed. It used to be pretty slow.
Okay.
And I'm trying to like equate it to another song, but it was sort of that type of like almost like a You're So Bad strumming pattern, but slow, really slow.
Yeah.
Just kind of trudging, you know. And so at some point we were getting ready to bring it into the studio. I just thought, all right, let me see if I can really take this up a notch and just play it as fast as I can with a busy strumming pattern. And that way I think it allowed the rest of the arrangement to sort of just sit on like the clouds, you know, like the,
right.
those organs and synthesizers. The guitar is really, I mean, we added the drums in too, but the guitar is really the thing that's driving the song. So there doesn't need to be a big piano line that's like, you know, fully on all
yep.
the things. It can just kind of sit and like, kind of like the intro to Crawling Back to You. I'm trying to equate it to Tom Petty Project Thinks as well. You
That's
know, good. You know how everything can kind of just float on top of that one root.
Yeah. Well, it's, again, it, you know, the danger going into the studio sometimes is, well, we've got a full studio, we can add 64 tracks. Well, you don't, you know, Petty was always good at, like, take as much out as you can, basically, and still have the song be really, really good, but don't leave things in just because you can.
Right.
And I think the balance on this one is really good. I mean, the soul in this one, I mean, I've said, you know, Crawling Back to You, Time to Move On, sorry, with the tempo, but the soul is very Boys of Summer to me, and it's got that similar tone. It's got a ton of echo on it or a delay on it. And they're not like, it's not a big flowing solo. They're short phrases. So was that you as well? Did you play the
that
solo?
That was me. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a good solo, man. I really, really like
it. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. That was sort of just from a gear standpoint, a wake up call, that solo, because, you know, we're sitting in this, that was the last thing we did.
Okay.
Was the solo. We had the whole song was done and we were listening back. I didn't know what really to put there. You know, part of me wanted to put like kind of like a Wilco type, just like, let's just have the drums do whatever the hell they want. And like just big fills and like offbeat and like have all these synthesizers like rise up to like a wrong chord or something. Like I really thought that would be cool and just kind of like grating in a good way. And I think Tyler had the good sense of saying, let's not do that to an otherwise pretty predictable song. And so I think there's some place for that in some of the new songs I'm writing. But so we ended up doing a solo, but we're sitting in the studio with, I mean, Lake House Studio in Asbury Park is really an incredible space, and they have so much gear. They have just walls of amps and everything. And we just did plug directly into Logic.
Okay.
And just with Logic, or I guess it was Pro Tools, because the studio uses Pro Tools, but Tyler uses Live. It was one of those things, you know. but we use like a preamp on the computer. On
okay.
A Mac. We and like behind me are these like vintage Princetons and like all this like Mount Rushmore guitar gear.
Yeah.
And we said, let's just keep it simple, and that way he can go home and, you know, work on it and change whatever he wants. And he mixed it really well, and it's not in your face, but it just kind of sits on everything. And so I'm really happy with the way we did it. And I think it's thank you. I appreciate it. I think it's a cool solo too. It's
it
not
fits.
What we normally play.
It fits, so man. Like it's exactly the right part for the song. And that's the important thing, right? Anytime you're putting a song together there's nothing worse than, you know, say you had gone into a little, like a Slash type solo or something. They'd be like, yeah, it's good, but I don't know. Or if you'd done that where you'd broken out into some sort of syncopated polyrhythm or you've got it, I think it would have broken up the song, right? It's not right for the song. You need to serve the song and you do it beautifully. I had a question too about the bass on this one. Is that a fretless bass on this song?
No.
Okay, it isn't, because there's a couple of little slides. I was like, And I'd love to hear that isolated because it's really got a, it's got that Tony Levin thing almost. I was like, no, dude, that's fretless.
I appreciate it. I played the bass too, so I really appreciate that compliment because I don't consider myself a bass player by any means. But that bass, I think it was just a Fender P bass. I don't think it was anything special. Might have been a Rickenbacker, but I think it was a Fender P bass. I remember on the Brooklyn Can Wait session, which was again like that brain freeze and happy something was just me and Tyler in the studio.
Yeah.
And for Brooklyn Can Wait, we spent like an hour testing out different basses. I played it four times on the Rick and four times on the Fender and four times on a Gretsch. And like I don't remember even what we landed on. So when we went in for this session, which we did Happy Something and Brain Freeze at the same time, we kind of walked into it remembering what we learned last time and it took a lot quicker. But I think Brain Freeze was a Rickenbacker, I think. And Half Beats Nothing was a P bass.
Yeah, I mean, really, you can use a Rickenbacker and you use all these, but you really only need a P bass. You only need a Fender, really. A Fender will do everything you need it to do.
Right. So.
There you go. Yeah, I mean, it's just the most versatile, one of the most versatile guitars ever made, right? Really. Which is the reason why I still use them. And again, some great lines in this song I'd written down. You know, it's much easier to start than it is to try again.
Thank
it applies to so many aspects of life, right? Relationships, songwriting. And it's funny because I'm a programmer. So every programmer, you don't want to fix someone else's code. You don't want to sort of work on something. Let's just do it again. Right. So it's that sort of that tendency that we'd rather chase something new than try and make the familiar better or keep it working. Right. So that's, I think that line captures that sentiment just beautifully.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah. I just sort of had an image of that. And really, I don't know if I meant it at the time, but I think this song is sort of a rewrite of a song from down the line called Trying Again. And that was one of the oldest songs that I had on Down the Line. It was I wrote it when I was like 13 or something like that. There's a couple songs I listen to. I'm not that I'm sitting around listening to any of my songs, but like, you know, that'll come on when I'm trying to make a set list for something with the band or something. And I'm like listening to pick songs. And I wonder how that snuck onto the record. So that I can look at it almost 5 years later, 4 years later. But and I think that's what I was trying to say in Trying Again.
Right.
But I don't know if I didn't think I really got there, but I was kind of had in mind the same guy and like just the guy that decided, you know, it was easier to pick up and move states than it was to like make a bunch of apologies and where he's living now.
Yeah.
You
know? Captured a bit of it. And life ain't giving back the time it steals is the other line I love in there. Cause you know, I'm 50 and I feel that every freaking day, man, let me tell you, time is not my friend anymore. I've got way more behind me than I've got ahead of me. So.
Well, that line I was trying to, that line has sat on for a really long time. I forget what song that was originally in, but it just didn't fit. It might have been Rolling Away. I'm not sure, but whatever it was, it just, I knew that the line was good. I just couldn't figure out where to put it, you know, and so finally it kind of sat in nicely.
Well, that's where, you know, again, people who don't write songs don't know that we cannibalize. You know, I can't use that verse, but that line, I know I'm going to use that eventually. So.
I don't think I've written a newer song in like 5 or 6 years. It's like a sourdough starter, you know, like people that like have them from like the 1700s or whatever. Like all of my songs are just things I've cut 2 years ago that I can figure out how to use now.
Yeah.
You know,
it's nice though when you, because you know, we talked a little bit earlier about Wildflowers and things. When you're in that prolific sort of space, keep writing, man, because you never know when you're going to need it and when you're going to use it. But this song, I mean, that's cool that this is your favorite song now, because it was one that it took a little while. This was a grower for me. This was one that I wasn't sure about on first listen. But the more of it, it's one of those where every time I listen to it, it gets that little bit better. And I notice something else again, because there's lots of corners to look around in this song. It's not as simple as you make it sound, right? There's lots of stuff going on in there. It's just subtle. So I like listening to it and thinking, I didn't really notice that before. And again, people, if you listen to this, please listen to these songs on the headphones. Listen to all songs on the headphones as well as on your stereo, because you learn so much more.
Yeah, that was mixed by Tyler as well.
Okay.
He's nothing, and you know, he's really good at figuring out how to make it sound cool, you know.
Yeah.
And he's a lot of the mind behind those synth. There's something in the song that he put. Typically, I would just send him a demo. I would do a demo, send him stems, and then he would add some stuff, and we'd kind of find something, then just redo it in the studio.
Yeah.
And one thing, it's something in the second verse.
There's like a little bit of a synth climb, like a very breathy synth.
Yeah.
And I just love how that sits there. That's all him. So I appreciate that, you know?
Yeah. It's great, eh? When you give someone a song and it comes back and it's better. It's like, yeah. Tom always, oh, yeah, saying, you know, give, we give a song to Ben Mon, it always comes back better. So.
Right. Yeah.
So The Dreamer, you said, like, that's, so that's the oldest song then. That's, we think, it's been around, because I was looking, yeah, March 2021, I found. Along, that was just you playing it on piano, I think. But I like the this word ended up, because you've got this rope-a-dope that you do that it's like, okay, well, it's this stripped back digital piano, and you don't see that build into the, it's not digital.
No, but everyone thinks that. I think that's just how it was mixed. We did that on like a 9-foot grand.
Really?
But it was mixed very compressed.
Yeah, and I mean, I would never have, if I hadn't spoken to you, if someone else had told me, no, that's a real idea, I'd get out. No, that's digital, definitely. Wow, okay.
Yeah, no, that song is cool. The mix of that is cool. That was, I think it's different than a lot of the other mixes that we have on the record. That was mixed by David Bendith, who has a pretty incredible, you know, discography of his own. You know, he's been around, you know, so many. I mean, he's incredible in and of himself. But that's a very compressed song. I think it kind of fits the song. But yeah, that piano, it's a really special, great piano they have there. Like, I don't remember what it is. Like, I guess it's a Steinway or something like that. I don't know. But whatever it is, it's a really great piano. I'm trying to think of same piano as Keeping It Alive, but he mixed that too. So they might sound similar. I'm trying to think of another record that it was on, but I'm sure I'll get there. But, you know.
Yeah. And it's got that, you know, it's one with a big, I'd say, you know, again, back to your influences, because they do filter through. It always sounds like Jake Thistle first and foremost, but this is a Jackson Browne chord progression to me. This one's like, yeah, I could see Jackson covering this one. I could see him doing a good job of this one live. It would suit him. He would like this one, you know.
Thank you.
And again, the pause in the beat doesn't come exactly where you're expected in this, where you cut there with the drums cut out, because it's on the four, but it's slightly behind the beat as well. It's a bugger, because I'm trying to count it. Like, is it on the three, Ander? No, I think it's on the four, but I can't quite hear it. It's really, really cool. It's a fun way to move the song along again, right? Like, it's just,
Thank you.
I'm just a huge nerd to those little things, so.
I appreciate it. Yeah, that song was a blast. That, you know, that's when we had the full band in there. And that was cool, too, because I worked with them on Ghosted Road in July of 22. And I hadn't seen or talked to any of them until we did this, which was December. So it was really nice to kind of catch up with them and give them a couple new songs and, you know. Because, you know, since then, after I worked with them on that, I started bringing them out, you know, and doing some more full band original gigs and things like that, which is, kind of, I guess, primarily what I do these days. Although I do a lot of acoustic stuff, too. But that was cool, because that was like a big catch up. You know, we did a couple of rehearsals, but it was cool to just kind of see what they were up to and thinking about with the song, because they hadn't heard anything in between. Whereas now, if we were to go in the studio, they've heard a ton of other songs that they hadn't played on. You know, but this was kind of like just like a second try, you know?
Yeah. Man, the harmonies in this song, the production on it soars above everything else, the harmonies in the chorus. And I think they're so beautifully captured and so nicely mixed. And then the solo is almost like this mandolin style, but I'm assuming that was played on electric guitar. But it's got that kind of.
And then that was really cool. That was Nick Nella, who's the really great guitar player. I believe he also sang that harmony you're talking about.
Okay.
I think that, I don't remember if I did that or he did that, but I think he did that. And if so, I think that's his only harmony. He sang a lot in the studio, but I'm trying to remember now.
Yeah.
No, he sang harmonies on Keeping It Alive too, for sure. But I think that's probably his most prominent harmony is in The Dreamer, way, keep an eye off, you know, that's him. Yeah, he did that solo, and it was, we were trying to figure out what to put there. I had been playing it on piano.
Okay.
Not like that, like, you know, just kind of like in a weird, like, kind of lead sheet way where I was like placing the chord behind it and just doing stuff. And so when he said, why don't we try it like this, and he started doing it on guitar, it kind of like changed, like all of us looked up and was like, oh, shoot. So from there on, I went back and I just did it in four piano octaves, just like my thumbs and pinkies, just doing it. And then we did, we brought out the Glockenspiel.
Okay.
So it's pretty cool.
Some layering on there. Nice. Yeah. And again, I mean, I was talking to you about your lyrics. I mean, this is maybe, you know, you're starting to forget who sung different vocals. This is why I think that every album record we'll have to do this, because then in 20 years I can write conversations with Jake Thistle and we'll have, you know, contemporaneous memories that you'll be able to tell me exactly who played what. But
hey,
this morning I punched myself through the mirror on the wall. Now I'm picking up all the shattered pieces of me. And it goes back to, again, that cinematic ability that you have to sort of paint this, because that's obvious, that's a very obvious picture. It's very explicit. But then because you come back to it again, you revisit that line in the breakdown before that last chorus to tie all that, to tie that line back up together. And again, that's that thing of watching a songwriter grow and thinking, I don't know whether you would have done that 4 or 5 years ago, where you sort of, you know, to pull that line and think, okay, well, that's a good image. So I'll just drop that in here. And it's not going to be exactly the same. I'm not going to repeat it, but I'm going to use the same idea. So that ties together. Very, very cool.
Yeah. That was one of the songs, I wrote it in January of 21. So like that was the first song I wrote after Down the Line.
Yeah.
At least the first good song I wrote after Down the Line. It was like another 6.5 minute, or, you know, like there was a ton of different lyrics and Mirror on the Wall was there, I think, from the beginning.
Okay.
But that the bridge wasn't that callback to it. I had the way it was structured, it was like a verse, bridge, chorus, verse, bridge, chorus. Oh, it wasn't the bridge when I wrote it, but after I trimmed all that out, I just made it bridge.
Yeah.
We would have to look at that March demo you were talking about, but I don't know where you are. Seems if you left my reflection, there was definitely some other line there that I didn't, okay. I didn't gravitate toward as much. And that's why it, and I ended up calling back to the mirror, but that writing was, must've been in 23, you know?
Right.
Cause after we did Ghosted Road and Rolling Away, which were fairly new songs, I decided instead of writing new songs for Joe and the label to go back and see, because I figured this is a new moment of my career. And if I don't at least look back for a little bit, I'm going to lose everything I've done between Down the Line and now. Because if I just start writing. So I went back and that's where I pulled Keeping It Alive and The Dreamer.
Yeah.
There were other songs in there that I've just been lost. You know, I still have them. Sometimes they pop in my head. But for the most part, those are the two that I thought should be brought back and reevaluated. And then when it says that, then I actually wrote the next three, you know, for the record.
Yeah, let's go to the album Closer Rolling Away. Like I said, this is another one that has become one of my favorite tracks on the album. For that, I wouldn't really be able to articulate why, but it's the feel of it. There's just something about the way it feels. And again, when I start thinking back to Brooklyn Can Wait and consider them as two sort of, you know, the yin and yang, the two halves of the coin. It's just, you couldn't finish it. You couldn't close this album with any other song on it, for sure. And I don't know how you would write something that fits better.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. I always had the idea that this would be the closer. And I actually, this is one of the rare songs that I didn't want to be dynamic. I thought, you know, it's short enough.
Yeah.
And then we sped it up a lot. And now it's under 3 minutes, which is very rare for me. And I think the only song I've ever put out that's under 3 minutes. I just didn't think it needed to have all this, like, you know, like The Dreamer is so, like, the bridge, no drums. And, you know, I feel like a lot of the other songs have that similar structure of, like, we didn't start out with drums and now we have it. Oh, and then now the bridge, there's no drums. And then we're back with drums, you know?
Yeah.
So for this song, I thought, let's just keep it all at, like, 60% the whole time and kind of close out on just, like, a kind of a stagnant, interesting thing, you know.
Yeah,
that was kind of where my mind was for the re-recording of it, and it's the only song that doesn't have drums.
Yeah,
those are all MIDI, you know, Logic stuff.
Yeah,
just because of where we recorded it, we didn't have drums there.
It doesn't need it either, though, right? Like you said, I mean, if you're going for that vibe, if you threw acoustic drums in there, I mean, obviously you can mix them, make them sound in different ways, or trigger them, or whatever, but you'd lose, I think that's that indescribable thing that I love. You'd lose it if you over-egged it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I think the guitar sounds interesting on it too. It was really funny because I had played a Martin on everything on the record except for Brooklyn Can Wait, I used a Gibson. But everything else was either my CEO, I don't have a bit here, I guess I would have brought him out, but my CEO 7, you know, which is like that smaller Martin, or the 74 D35 that have been playing a lot. So for this one, when I went down, I didn't go down with a guitar because they have plenty. And Jake had said, he said it just would be an interesting sound. I didn't hear it until we thought about it, because I love Martin. I'm attached to Martin. I don't like not playing Martin. And he had a Martin there, so I said, we're just going to do that. But he said, let's try a Taylor, which I don't really like.
Right.
Mix like a Martin. And he thought it would sound cool. And so that's what we did. He EQ'd it like a Martin, but it was a Taylor. And I think it's an interesting sound. It's a little bit of a sharper sound.
Yeah. It's bright is not exactly the right word, is it? But I know what you mean. It's got a different... Man, I'm struggling to... It's more... not metallic's not the right word either, because they're simply strings, but there is a different tone to it, definitely.
Yeah.
Especially if you know what a Martin sounds like, and a Martin just sounds like a Martin, but... again, I'm going to jump back into lyrics again with you, Jake. So, and this clown car holds one, and I'm that lonely soul. Again, you sort of... You have this, again, another sort of...
I had to put lonely soul somewhere. I took it out of Ghost Road and I put it there.
But it's not, it works there because it's not cliche, because you've got that clown car thing. And I think then that pair of sort of ideas works really well. And you don't fall back on cliche. That's sort of one of the things I like about it, because how careful are you about that? Like, is that something you look at and think, you've already said, like, you know, you don't want to use long soul and all these kinds of things, but how naturally does that come? Do you do a lot of editing after and think, shit, I've done it again? Or have you got to a stage now when you're writing where you know how to avoid the pothole before it comes up on the road?
Well, I think it's my biggest fault as a writer is I will, if I feel a cliche coming, I just stop writing the song.
Okay.
It's pretty, like, you know, it's funny. I forget who I was talking to about this, but I mean, at this point in my career, I'm still very early on.
Yeah.
You know, like, if I dropped dead tomorrow, you couldn't do Half Left Out and all the rest like they did with Wild.
Right.
Because what I write is what I've put out. I don't have another album of stuff I cut. You know, there are obviously every release, there are three or four songs that didn't make it that could have. But for the most part, the songs I finish are the songs I take to the label and bring out. And if I'm writing a song and if I'm a verse in, three verses in, it doesn't matter how far. If I'm not feeling it, or I've come to a point where I want to say, you know, some sort of cliche, I tend to just stop and start writing a different song. And then 3 months later, I'll pull a line from that and kind of revitalize it. I guess the answer is yes, I'm very careful of it, but it's not something I've learned to avoid. It's just, I avoid it by not doing it. But I think that's kind of an immature response that I'm hoping to get out of at some point.
Well, I think though, I mean, that's just your style of writing, right? I mean, it's not like you haven't got 7 fantastic songs on this record. So it's not like you obviously haven't walked away from Wildflowers, or, you know, you don't know how it feels. So I always sort of think that your songwriters should probably trust their instincts. Like, as soon as you've got your own identity, a certain, which you already have, you've established that already, that if it's working, don't mess around too much with it, because you might find that it tips the balance the other way, you know?
Yeah, I suppose. I'm trying, you know, I feel like even in the worst song, there's at least one interesting idea I can take later. So
yeah.
I'm trying to see them through a little bit more, because maybe I get 2 ideas out of it instead of 1.
Yeah.
But I do not like writing a song that I don't like.
Yeah.
I hate it.
Yes.
I hate it.
There's nothing worse though, too, eh? Going back through your memos and your notes and thinking, you know, you record something into your phone, and you think, what the hell was I thinking? That's awful.
Right.
I don't know what.
That's the other bad part. Yeah. Is I'll write a song and you know, I'm saying I only finish a song if I think it's a good song. But like the notebook's right here, I could just pull up a random page. What the hell was I thinking? And this is the song I finished, you know?
Or what's worse sometimes is, oh shit, that's Let It Be. I've just rewritten Let It Be subconsciously. Rass, I can't use that then. So,
right, exactly.
But I love too the way that, as I said, as a closer, picking the right song for the closer. And one of the other things I love about this, it doesn't finish on the root. So you leave it on that. I don't know if it's the fourth or something. So it's almost like it's leaving the album open to a sequel, which I think is super, super cool. And again, what I'd said to you with Brooklyn Can't Wait and Rolling Away being the bookends for this, in my head, in the cinema that you created in my head, one of the Jake characters maybe and the female character in Brooklyn Can Wait end up together. But this song then is sort of 10 years later when the relationship's maybe not in such a great place, and they're trying to patch it back up. But as a listener, you think, I think you just need to, you need to roll away now. This is done. Yeah. You need to get away. So I think, like I said, visually for me, that's what really struck me when I listened, you know, because you listen, I've talked about this with people, but you listen passively just to enjoy music. When you're listening to write something interesting to ask, then you listen critically, and that really hit me. Then it's like, yeah, that really works as a narrative, and to have that at both ends of the album, it's just chef's kiss.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it. I was trying to just convey, like, I feel like the idea that people use, like, you know, when they say we got time, it's fine, like whatever. I feel like that's often used as an excuse to and not do it. But I don't think that's not insurance that you're going to. So I want to try to, you know, talk about that.
Awesome. Well, you know, there's 7 songs. It's a short album because we had 12 songs on the, you know.
It's an awkward, you know, we planned it to be an EP.
Yeah.
5 songs or something like that. And then I kept giving him stuff and we just said, all right, whatever. So it's pretty funny because we exclusively refer to it as an EP, like in the Golden Retriever Records office.
Yeah.
But like Spotify and all those, they consider it an album.
Yeah.
So I'm glad we did it like that because, you know, I had announced that I was going to be putting out an EP, and 7 songs is like a pleasant surprise. At least if you like the songs, it's pleasant. You know, it was like, I thought it was going to be an EP. This is like 3 more songs than I thought it would be. So I'm glad we did that instead of calling it a record and having it being half what a record should be. So,
right. You know,
the next release will be a full release. You know, we're 12 songs, something like that, you know.
Well, let's talk about that, what's coming up then. So you've got a live album that's going to be coming. You just finished live recording at the Transparent Clinch Gallery. Did I get that right?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. A beautiful space in Asbury Park. It was a blast. It was so much fun. That's going to be, I think, we're still working on the track list. We recorded 15 songs.
Okay.
We're going to probably put out 12. So we're going to try and pick. It's going to be all of the Half Left Out. Probably border. You know, some of them are very similar. Some of them are pretty reimagined. Rolling Away, it's like this poor song has seen yet another version now. We did like a super stripped down piano version, super slow and quiet. And I'm excited to hear how that gets mixed. And that'll probably be the closer in this record too. But so all of the Half Left Out, 2 songs from Down the Line, and 3 unreleased songs.
Oh, cool.
That will be probably on the next project.
Okay.
But it's interesting because it was just me and an accompanist who was Gordon Brown, who's from a band called Williams Honor. He is him and Reagan Richards, who are in Williams Honor, they're incredible musicians and very talented. And they've been around and done everything, you know. And he's a great producer, great writer. So I was really thrilled to work with him. But it's pretty stripped down. It was mostly him on guitar, me on guitar or piano.
Yeah.
And so it's cool. It's kind of a stripped down live album, but it's not, I mean, I guess it's acoustic, but it's not solo. So it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting thing. I'm really excited for how it's going to turn out.
So what's the timeline for that? And what sort of formats? Is that going to be digital only, or are you going to do CDs of that? Or
We're probably going to do a limited run of CDs. Everybody who bought the ticket to the show will get one. The timeline for that, you know, I'm going in tomorrow to start mixing it, you know. So it's going to be great. Probably May is probably a realistic timeline that hedges my bets, because I don't want to say April, because it's, now that I see the date, it's almost April. Well, I'll say May and we'll hope for the best. But no, mid-May is probably when we're doing it. And I think it's a great way to kind of close out this era of Jake Thistle. Not that it was ever that serious, but, you know, now I can really kind of put this to bed and start, you know, really writing and looking at the new record, which I've already written. You know, I have about 8 or 9 demos for it that I want to ship out. And I think they're pretty different from some of the other stuff I've done in a multitude of ways. And I'm excited for that. It's going to be great.
Well, you know, for us fans, it's great too, because we hear little previews of these songs. Like you said, I think I just always prefer when a song doesn't remain static over time. I like when an artist says, well, let's try it this way, let's try it that way, let's do this, let's do that. Because, you know, my good friend, my best friend, Randy, who is a prolific songwriter, producer, sound, you know, does all that kind of song plays. He says, what you basically do is you write a song, then you record the song, and then you figure out how the hell you're going to do it live. So you're basically sort of doing a cover version of your own song, right? So
yeah, exactly. I mean, there's never been a time I haven't, you know, people, the question I always get is like, oh, now that, you know, Down the Line's been out for 3 years, or the Half-Life Alyx been out for 7 months or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, are there things that you would do differently? And it's just always such a funny question to me, because like I will get in, you know, if the studio session ends at 8 o'clock, I will get in my car at 8:01 and go, oh, I should have sang that differently. Time has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
The second the words leave my mouth, I wish I said them different. So yeah. I've always loved playing live. That's always been something I've gravitated towards. And so I'm always excited to figure out how to do it. And it's also a really great challenge because, you know, typically my band, it's myself on guitar or piano, depending on what is most predominantly in the song. A second guitar doing background vocals, a drummer and a bassist. So for Ghosted Road, when we did that, it was super easy when we play that live. That's what that is. Okay, we miss a little bit of organ, but whatever, who cares? but now when we're sitting down to do, you know, Half Beats Nothing or Brooklyn Can Wait, like suddenly that becomes a challenge on how are we putting this song together, and are we using tracks, and what am I doing? And, you know, so it's interesting. It's fun. That was, I think the hardest, the biggest challenge was, I guess Brooklyn Can Wait, because it was, I have to play guitar on it.
Yeah.
Because it was that driving acoustic, but there's also a lot of piano work in it. And, I could also have played piano on it. And so that's always the challenge, is figuring out what I'm going to do and how I can manage to put that all together nicely, you know, so that the audience hears something a little different, but still kind of what they were expecting.
What you got to do is you just got to play the strum the pattern. And then when he gets a diddle in, just like leave that ring it open, just play that with your right hand quickly back to the guitar. You can do it.
That's
I'm
right.
sure you can do it.
Yeah. So at some point I'll have to bite the bullet and add a piano player, but
yeah. Call Benmont. He's sitting around in California doing nothing. I'm sure he'll come out, right?
I'm sure.
Okay, well, look, thanks so much for jumping on again, man. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of this album. You know, I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm looking forward to whatever comes next. I'm looking forward to the live album and the next album that comes out after that. Like I said, in 20 years, when it's time to do a conversation with Jake Thistle, give me a call, because I want dibs on that. So,
all right. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. This is such a blast.
Let people know where they can find you on social media, what's the website, all those kinds of things.
Sure, yeah. I'm at jakethistle.com, which is kind of, you know, the link to everything you need. And then it's Jake Thistle on Facebook, Jake Thistle Music on Instagram. So chances are if you put my name and maybe music after that, you'll find me wherever, you know.
Find you somewhere. Awesome. Okay, well, thanks so much for doing this, man. We'll speak to you later.
I can't wait. Thank you.